How many of you have ever been away from home for months, maybe even close to a year, and then you went back home and slept in your own bed? You ever have that happen? When Doug was singing that song, I was thinking about my first year of Bible college. I was away at school. First time I'd really ever been away from home. And I was sleeping on a bunk bed, had three other guys in the room. And after I finished that first year, I didn't go home. I went to Macon, Georgia. And I worked with my uncle in a trailer hitch shop Monday through Saturday in Macon. That's where I learned to wire trailers and basically weld a little bit. That's where it started. And then I went home. And can I tell you that the first night that I laid in that bed, it just felt good. It just felt good. And can I tell you that it's been well over 40 years now since I have really slept in that bed. I think maybe one time, right after Deb and I first married, whenever we went to see my folks, we slept in that room. But one time in over 40 years, but I can still tell you what that bed feels like. It was nothing like just getting in that bed, have that little window unit air conditioner blowing wide open, and I'm telling you, that was some good, good sleep. And that's a good song, Doug. I appreciate you singing that tonight. Well, I want you to turn in your Bibles to 2 Samuel. 2 Samuel. We're going to begin in chapter 1 tonight. We're going to get through about half the chapter. And I'm going to be preaching tonight on this title, Caught in a Lie. Caught in a Lie. Now the background, of course, is 1 Samuel 31. And I think I've probably mentioned this over the last year and a half that it took me to get through 1 Samuel. But in the Jewish Bible, you don't have 1 and 2 Samuel. You only have Samuel. You don't have 1 and 2 Kings. You have just Kings. You don't have Chronicles or 1 and 2. You've got just Chronicles singular. You don't have Judges in Ruth. You have just one book. And so when you read through a Jewish Old Testament, it's a little different in the way that it's put together and organized. And so because of that, I decided that I would just go ahead and just keep going so that we could see the continuation of what we had in the first 31 chapters of 1 Samuel. Now, in the last message that I preached, I talked about the fact that Israel had been defeated, that Saul has been killed, Jonathan has been killed. The nation of Israel is in disarray. The Philistines now have the upper hand. They have no leadership that's official as yet. And yet, we come into 2 Samuel in reality with hope. And I think the reason that we know there's hope there is because of the main character that we'll see in this book, and that is the person of David. Everybody knows that David is God's man. The people of Israel have known it for quite some time, but one of the things that is so beautiful about David is he never pushed the subject. He never tried to make it happen himself. He was willing to let God bid his time. He was willing to just simply say, whatever God wants is okay with me. And that is a wonderful attitude that all of us ought to have. If we believe that our everyday steps are directed by God, then there's no sense in us being anxious. There's no sense in us trying to push the envelope. Just let God work. And I think that we'll see that as we go through 2 Samuel. Now, when you look at the first chapter here, one of the things that you will see, and as we read through this, you're going to see the story that is told by an Amalekite. There's a man that comes into the camp of David, and he begins to tell the story of Saul. The problem that we have in our Bible, though, is this, that in 1 Samuel 31 and in 1 Chronicles 10, those two accounts of Saul's death does not square with what we have seen in chapter 1 of 2 Samuel. So what I want us to do tonight is I want us to simply read through the passage, and then I will comment whenever we get through it. And so I want you to look with me at verse number 1. Now it came to pass after the death of Saul, when David was returned from the slaughter of the Amalekites. You remember, David is fighting on a different front than Saul was. Saul was fighting in a place called Gilboa, in a mountain area. And so it says here that David had abode 2 days in Ziklag. And of course, Ziklag was a Philistine city that was roughly 80 miles from Gilboa. Keep that in mind, all right? And it says that it came to pass on the third day, in other words, the third day that he was back from the battle with the Amalekites, that behold, a man came out of the camp from Saul with his clothes rent or torn and earth upon his head. Now remember, the coming out of the camp from Saul, that does not mean that he was part of Saul's army. It simply means that he had been at the camp and he had come out of that camp. That's very key. So keep that in mind. And so it was when he came to David that he fell to the earth and did obeisance. And David said unto him, "From whence comest thou?" And he said unto him, "Out of the camp of Israel am I escaped." And David said unto him, "How went the matter? I pray thee, tell me." And he answered, "That the people are fled from the battle, and many of the people also are fallen and dead, and Saul and Jonathan his son are dead also." That had to be a piercing of David's heart. He respected Saul because he was God's anointed, but he loved David as his own soul. And so the young man that told him said, "As I happened by chance upon Mount Gilboa, behold, Saul leaned upon his spear." You ought to circle that word because that's key. "And lo, the chariots and the horsemen," that's of the Philistines, "followed hard after him. And when he looked behind him, he saw me, and he called unto me, and I answered, 'Here am I.' And he said unto me, 'Who art thou?' And I answered him, 'I am an Amalekite.'" That's almost ironic because you remember the thing that cost Saul his throne was the fact that he was to destroy the Amalekites and he did not do it. And so verse 9 says, "And he said unto me again, 'Stand, I pray thee, upon me and slay me. For anguish has come upon me because my life is yet whole in me.' So I stood upon him and I slew him, and I was sure that he could not live after that he had was fallen." In other words, he's saying, "I just went ahead and killed him because he wasn't going to live anyway. And I took the crown that was on his head and the bracelet that was on his arm, and I have brought them hither unto my Lord." The first thing that I want you to see in this account, I want you to see that David is approached with deception. When I mentioned that there are conflicting accounts in 1 Samuel 31 and 1 Chronicles 10, along with the companion passage of 2 Samuel 1, I want you to notice there's some things that you need to be very, very aware of. There's nowhere in 1 Samuel 31 that it says that Saul's armor bearer had ever been injured. If his armor bearer was not injured, that means that he was ready to protect Saul at all cost. There would have been nothing that would have happened that he would not have been willing to risk his own life for to protect his king. But yet, this man says that he came upon Saul on the mountains of Gilboa, and he said, "Saul called me and said, 'Stand over me.'" Do you really think that an armor bearer who was a fighting man, do you really think that if he would not be willing to kill Saul the king, that he's going to let somebody else do it, to kill him? I don't think so. And so we see that there's the issue of the armor bearer. So therefore, the deception is starting to unwind a little bit. Now, you got to remember, David doesn't know any of what's happened. This is his first hearing. But I want you to notice as we get toward the end of the message that God gives David great discernment. David is able to look at people, and he's able to make good decisions. And so we see that this Amalekite said that I just stood over him, and because he told me to, and because he was injured, I went ahead and I killed him. And so it doesn't pass the armor bearer test. Also, when we take the account in 2 Samuel 1 and what happens in 1 Samuel 31, there's a difference in the weapons that he died from. If you look back at verse number in chapter 31, look with me back at verse number 4, I think it is. Yes. "But this armor bearer would not kill him, for he was sore afraid. Therefore Saul took a sword and fell on it." Flip back over to 2 Samuel chapter 1. And if you look, it says that he happened by in verse 6. And he says Saul leaned upon his spear. And so therefore it says that he died by a spear. And so you've got two different weapons that are mentioned here. And so he doesn't really even give any details about Jonathan other than that Jonathan's dead. And so I'm thinking that, you know, with the fact that he's telling this story, that David is probably already beginning to get the little vibes that maybe this guy may not be on the up and up, even though this is the first hearing, because he knows that Saul's armor bearer would be by. He knew that Saul had a sword. He knew also probably that Saul had a spear because he tried to kill him with it two or three times. But he mainly used a sword. And so you've got maybe a little bit of the deception that's beginning to be seen through. Now you got to remember that he's had several days to rehearse this story. It says that David had been in Ziklag for a third day. That could mean that at the beginning of that third day, and I really kind of think that because it says that he abode 2 days at Ziklag and then the third day. And so probably at the beginning of the third day, this man comes dragging in. Well, he has been walking this way for approximately 80 miles. And so he's had plenty of time to rehearse his story as he's coming to David. Well, he looks at his appearance and he says, "I've got to make this look good." And so what does it say? It tells us that in verse number 2, that his clothes were rent, they were torn, and supposedly this was to show grief. He had earth upon his head. You remember reading in the Bible about people that would sit in ashes and they would put sackcloth on and throw ashes on their head as a time of mourning. And so he's giving the appearance, and this adds to the ruse that he is trying to pull over on King David. Not only that, he bows down at the end of verse number 2. He makes obeisance to David. Now you say, why would he do that? Because this guy knows the lay of the land. All of Israel knows the lay of the land. Let's face it, for over 10 years, Saul has been chasing David all through the wilderness. David and his 600 men and their families, they have been sleeping in caves. They have been sleeping in ravines. They have been sleeping among the trees. They have been sleeping anywhere. They were living rough. And so this man knew what was happening. He knew every time David got away, he would hear those stories. And there's no doubt that those stories would pass quickly through a community. I mean, that would be front page news if they had newspapers at that time. And so he bows himself because he knows that David is next in line to be the king. Now, I think what he saw was a chance for a big payday. You say, well, what do you mean by that? Well, let me tell you something. When he picks up a crown that belongs to King Saul, he takes his armband off, something that's readily identified as the king. You don't just go to the local pawn shop and sell it. They would say, where did you get that? Well, those things were widely known about. So he's thinking, what can I do with this to get a benefit from? You say, now, preacher, why would you say that? Because that's what the Amalekite tribes did. They were a marauding people. They simply would scavenge. They would go into villages and they would rape, they would ransack, they would take anything they could that they considered to be a spoil. And that was just the way that tribe operated. Those people were almost a nomadic type people. And so they were looking to see whatever they could get and how could they turn the situation into a lucrative opportunity. And so I think that he's probably thinking, well, David is next in line, and if I take the king's crown and the king's armband to him, then maybe he'll give me a cushy job in his new government. Maybe he'll reward me with maybe some of the spoil that he has taken from some of the places that he has defeated. And so he's deceiving or trying to deceive King David. And we see that as you go through the first 10 verses. Now, the second thing that I want you to see tonight is I want you to see that David is aching with sorrow. Now, it's a little weird the way that the Bible writer, and by the way, we don't really know who wrote Samuel, all right? Some people think that multiple authors wrote parts of it. In 1 Samuel, I think that probably the prophet Samuel wrote much of it, but when he died, who wrote the rest of it? Some people think it was possibly Jeremiah, but nobody really knows for sure. And so we have the Bible writer's account. This is past muster as it was tested, and people looked at that and said, yes, this is part of the canon of God. It's the collection that God wants us to put together. And so it is now part of the whole Bible. And so you've got this portion of scripture in our passage tonight that's inserted here. And it seems to be really, really a difficult place to put it in. Now you would think as you're carrying on for conversation with the Amalekite, you would think that you would just finish that and then you would go into the grief process. If you look at number 11, verse 11, he says, the writer says, then David took hold of his clothes and he rent them. And likewise, all the men that were with him. And they mourned and they wept. They fasted until even. In other words, here it is, probably in the morning. They hear about Saul. They hear about Jonathan. They hear about the other men that have died. They hear about all of these deaths. And it breaks their heart. And when it breaks their heart, All I'm thinking is, these are the people that were trying to kill you. It's only been just a few days ago that Saul was hot on your trail with 3,000 of his choice troops. I mean, you're thinking about these men that have now died in that battle with those Philistines. Those are men that are not going to be chasing you anymore. Yet, because this was the kindred people of David and his 600 men, there was something inside of them that was very, very sad. It was a grievous time for them. And can I tell you that there are times when you have families and you have close friends and people that you have gotten along with and you have been through thick and thin with, and then there's an out that you may have with them. Can I tell you that there comes a time when you've got to lay that aside just for the sake of respect during a grieving time? Now you've got to think about what David's hearing. For the first time, he's hearing about these deaths. He's hearing the story of it. But yet, right in the midst of that morning conversation, he stops and he begins to tear his clothes and begins to mourn. And they say, "Do you want something to eat?" "No, no, no, I don't want anything to eat." And his men begin to do the same thing. All I could think about when I was reading this passage this week and thinking about this passage, all I was thinking about was the American Civil War. How that there would be families that would have a boy that would be fighting on the northern side and another boy that would be fighting on the southern side. Can you imagine how that would tear those families apart? But yet when one of those boys would die in some battle somewhere, it grieved the heart of the surviving boy. One of the fascinating movies and I guess documentaries that I've ever seen was the one that Ken Burns did on the Civil War. I mean, you had brother fighting against brother. And this is what you have in our passage here. And so it's no wonder. Sure, they were going to probably have to fight each other. But then when one of them dies, there's an emptiness that is now there. They don't want food anymore because the grief is real. And there are times when our griefs are real. If we were to divide this 16 verses up, which is what we're covering tonight, the first thing we would see would be we would see the arrival. Then the second thing in 3 through 10, we would see that conversation. And in that conversation that David and the Amalekite have, there's three questions that are asked. If you look at verse number 3, what you'll see is David will say, "Where did you come from?" And so he begins to say that I'm out of the camp of Israel and I'm escaped. In other words, I got away with my life. I was able to get away before they could kill me. We know that's not true. And the reason we know that's not true is because of the fact that he's telling this ruse. If he really had that happen, why not just be up front and say that, "Hey, I barely did get out. You know, I will tell you what happened." And David would have known that it rang true. And so there was the first question: where did you come from? Then he says, "How went the matter?" In other words, when you came out of the camp of Saul, what was it like when you were there? "Oh, Saul and Jonathan are dead. Many others are dead. There's people that are fleeing." And then he adds to it, "And while I was in Gilboa," and that's when the deception begins. And so we see that he had that second question. And then the question in verse 5, he says, "How knowest thou that Saul and Jonathan, his son, be dead?" In other words, he cared deeply about both of these men. Saul was his father-in-law. Now, he wasn't much of a father-in-law, but he was his father-in-law. Jonathan was his best friend. The scriptures tell us over in 1 Samuel 18 that their souls were knit together. One of the things that fascinated me as I've been going through our Sunday morning series was about when they cast lots and then they had the seamless garment. It had no seams. That thing was knit as one piece. Their souls were knit together just like that. And so he's wanting to know, what about my father-in-law? What about my brother-in-law and best friend, Jonathan? So we ask him those three questions, and when he gets his answer, the grieving begins. And then after that, he goes back. That evening, he goes back and he begins to question some more. There's two more questions, and we'll get to those here in just a moment. So I want you to see that David is aching with great, great sorrow. Grief cannot always wait. There may come a phone call tonight, and it may take sleep from you the rest of the night. I hope that does not happen. But every one of us at some point in our life, if you have not experienced it, you're going to experience it. It's just the way that it is. And so, grief cannot always wait. You've got the condition of God's people that's bothering him. You know why I know that? Because when David wins his last battle, what does he do? If you'd reread chapter 31 when you get home tonight or read it tomorrow, one of the things that you'll find is that he takes food and he begins to take it to different places that have been ravaged by the enemy. And he begins to give them food back and begins to help those people out. Why? Because those are his people. He cares about his people. One of the beautiful things that I saw in an email the other day that I read to the church was from Clixton Castillo. And he was so thrilled and so thankful and so filled with gratitude that our church would take him on a monthly basis. And he said, I just want you to know that I take part of the money that you're sending to me and I use that to buy food for my people. He said, as my pastor, I cannot in good conscience eat good and them not have anything. And all I'm thinking is, what a wonderful preacher. What a wonderful shepherd that he is willing to reach into his own pocket and give when his people are hurting. I think that's a great thing, and David exhibits that. It's no wonder that he could write Psalm 23 and talk about the Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want. And so this grief is something that he is feeling deeply. And I'm telling you, I think that if we're not careful, sometimes we display hard-heartedness. I would rather people come by here and be able to get money out of us that did not deserve it than somebody come by here that was deserving and we didn't give them a dime. I would rather, as Matthew Henry said one time when he was robbed, he said, I want to thank God for some things. He said, first of all, I want to thank God that even though I was robbed, they took my money, they did not take my life. He said, not only that, I want to thank God that even though they took my money, they didn't get much of it because I don't have much. And he said, the third thing I want to thank God for is that I was the one that got robbed and not the one that did the robbing. And so David, here he is, he's a man that just loves his people. And we ought to have a compassionate heart toward people. I can't help but think about the passages whenever it talks about how that I came and you ministered unto me. How did we do that, Lord? Well, I came and I was hungry and you fed me. I came and you were naked and you clothed me. And I think, Lord, help us to be a generous people. Help us to be willing to be taken if we're not discerning enough. But help us to always have compassion that Jesus did. Help us to not be a hard-hearted people. And so we see that David is aching with sorrow. But there's a third thing I want you to see tonight. I want you to see that David executes the deceiver. And somebody says, that's an awful thing. All the man did was lie and deceive. He didn't kill anybody. Can I tell you that he claimed to have killed somebody? He claimed that he killed Saul. He said, I stood over him. And basically, he said, I performed a mercy killing. I think this would probably be a good place to interject this. Can I tell you that God's not for mercy killing? Now, I know that it's beginning to be a popular thing in some of our college courses, and it's probably even reached down into some high school levels now. There's a term that they use called euthanasia. I was so dumb when I went to college and they were talking about euthanasia. I thought they were talking about teenagers that lived in China. Youth in Asia. I didn't realize it started with an E-U and not a Y-O-U. And so when I learned about euthanasia, I thought, wow. I mean, just because somebody's hurting so bad, they want you to inject them, they want you to shoot them, they want you to suffocate them. I mean, how could you live with yourself if you did that? But yet, we've got people today that do it. I mentioned a few months ago whenever the assembly, the legislature in New York State, they voted on the abortion. They made it the most liberal abortion laws in the country. You know how liberal it is? If a baby survives an abortion and is born alive, and that baby is laid over on a table, they voted that the mother and the doctor ought to still be able to kill it, even though it was born alive and survived an abortion. That's nothing but infanticide. And yet we've got one major party, and every one of their people that are running for the nomination adheres to that. I don't know how in God's name anybody that names the name of Christ could ever vote for one of those jokers. And so you've got euthanasia that is just front and center. I mean, you've got it on the front pages of our web pages when you're checking your local news. And so euthanasia was supposedly performed here, at least it was claimed. And because of that, he admitted to killing the anointed of God. And because of that, he was executed. Now, remember the two questions that I told you to look back at? Let's go ahead and deal with those now. If you look down at verse number, I think it's 14. No, verse 13. And David said unto the young man that told him, whence art thou? In other words, where do you come from? And he answered that I am the son of a stranger. Now that's not a stranger that's got dark glasses and a hat and a trench coat on. All right? This is a foreigner that has sought refuge in the country that he wants to be a part of. And so the inference in verse 13 is that this man has been here for a while. So therefore, he should have known what was happening. He knew that David was probably going to be the next king. He knew that Saul had been chasing David. He knew all kind of things. He should have known that it was not right because David had given them the example way back over several chapters before. In 1 Samuel 24, 1 Samuel 26, what do you find David doing? You find him within a sword's length of Saul, and his men are egging him on, killing, killing. David's like, no, no. I will not touch God's anointed. That would have been word that would have spread like wildfire. And so now you've got this man that's been living in this country for a while because his father brought him here. He knows what David has done and not done and why. And so the second question is found in verse 14. How wast thou not afraid to stretch forth thine hand to destroy the Lord's anointed? In other words, do you not have the fear of God? And can I tell you that there are people that do not have the fear of God today? There are people that think nothing of taking God's name in vain. There's people that think of nothing about besmirching a church. When I was a kid growing up, they didn't even lock churches. I remember whenever I was a little boy, I'd ride my bicycle to my grandparents' farm, and I mean from their porch, you can look across the fields and you can see the Pine Grove Baptist Church. And I'd get on that bicycle and I'd pedal over to the church. Wasn't anybody there. But I'd walk up those steps. I'd go in. They had red carpet and red pews. Had a wooden pulpit, wood in the back near where the baptistry was at. And I just look around for a little bit and I'm thinking, this is God's house. I like being in God's house. I wasn't even saved, but I had a fear of God. And I'd look around for a couple of 3 minutes and then I'd go out and I'd make sure the door was shut. I'd get back on my bicycle, head off somewhere else. I may ride to town or I may go back to the house and get a fishing rod. I mean, just whatever I felt like doing. But one of the things that I did on numerous occasions, I'd go over to the Pine Grove Baptist Church and just walk around inside, just seeing what was happening. Wasn't nothing happening. It was the same way all the time. But the door was never locked. I bet you if you went to that church tonight, I bet you it's locked. I bet there's dead bolts on every door. And they have people that probably have vandalized the place. You say, why do you say that? We've had it around here. I can't tell you the number of times we've had that bus barn broken into. At the old location, we had the church broken into. As a matter of fact, I think this church was broken into one time because I know we had a bass guitar that was stolen. I mean, you've got people that have no fear of God. But I'm going to tell you, they better have a fear of God. Because there's a judge that's going to sit on that great white throne judgment one day. Hey, and there's not going to be anybody that stands there with a stiff neck. No, they're going to be knocked to their knees. Every knee's going to bow. Every tongue's going to confess to the glory of God. And you're going to acknowledge King Jesus. Hey, when he comes back, he's not coming back as a lamb. He's coming back as the Lion of the tribe of Judah. He's the one that's going to take care of business. And I think that fear is a good thing. Some people say, oh, you ought not try to win people to the Lord with fear. Why not? I got saved because of fear. You say, I don't know if you really got saved. Let me tell you something. If I didn't get it, none of you got it. When I got saved, there's never been a doubt. And you know why I got saved? Oh, I knew Jesus loved me, but I'm going to tell you something. I thought I was on the next load to hell. And I didn't want to go. Jude tells us, it says in 22 and 23, and if some have compassion, but then it says, and others save with fear. I used to want to try to get people to understand, you know, you're going to hell. And if you get a guy realizing, hey, he's going to hell and he may be heading out there soon, it's going to sober him up a little bit. And so the fear of God is a great, great motivator. But now he really didn't kill Saul. So why should he die? David didn't know this. But yet he confessed that he had done it. And so because of Genesis chapter 9 verse 6, if you shed a man's blood, your blood's going to be shed. What does David do? David knows the man's lying. He says to another young man, he said, you go after him and you fall on him and you kill him. And that's exactly what takes place. This man is executed. And he's executed rightly because he was willing. If he had not been willing to kill Saul, he would have never uttered it from his mouth. And so David did right by executing this man. And can I tell you that I don't care how many legislators want to debate capital punishment, it works. It's a proven statistic that one out of one murderers that's executed never kills anybody else. It's 100%. You get somebody that kills somebody and they did murder, not manslaughter, where it was an accident, not where that it was self-defense, but where there's a clear case of murder. You execute them, they never kill anybody else. And I'm probably hard-hearted about this. I'm not so sure that I don't believe in the electric chair. I might believe in the electric couch. You know, I mean, I just think that, you know, when you kill somebody, I think you need to go right to the front of the line. Now, I mean, I think you ought to have appeals. My wife is into this TV program called Forensics. And, of course, if you want to make your wife happy, you watch what she wants to watch. So I'm watching a little bit of this, and there's been some guys that have gotten out because the proof, the DNA and all of that, proved that these guys were innocent. I'm talking about when there's no doubt about it. I'm talking about light up Sparky. And so David, he had him executed. I think that you and I, we ought to love the Lord, and we ought to want the Lord's name to be honored. Many years ago in Poland, there was a prince. His father had died, and he was to become king. And one of the things that this man did, he carried in his pocket. He carried a picture of his old dad. And he would take that picture out every once in a while, and the testimony was he would look at the picture, and he would say something like this: "Let me do nothing unbecoming for so excellent a father." In other words, he respected his father so much that he did not want to do anything that was not right. That ought to be the attitude that you and I have. I think really that David tried to have that attitude. And I'm going to tell you something. David's got some problems. David's main problem seems to be women. But I'm going to tell you something. The Bible says that David was a man after God's own heart. So I don't understand why God allowed David to do certain things. But I can tell you this, that when he was confronted, David always repented. And we need to have that attitude, because let me tell you something, just like David's not perfect, you and I aren't perfect. And so let's live our lives in an honest, honorable way. There was a writer in France many years ago, and his name was Jean Rousseau. He was a philosopher. And this man had a public persona that he was a family man. He would write books about child rearing and how to do this and how to do that. And he said, "There is no one in all of France that loves to spend time with children more than I do." But yet his public persona was totally different than his private life. In his private life, he had a mistress and had five illegitimate kids with her, and he never raised the one of them. May our public and private lives mesh. Let's not live lives of deceit as the Amalekite did. Let's make sure that we are doing our best to be honest, to make sure that there's no guile in our lives. And let's try to be people after God's own heart. Let's stand together.